This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
a similar decline in tourist traffic following this attack could be devastating. Government statistics show that 10% of Kenya's economy is related to tourism and travel.
That's VOA's Adam Phillips reporting. Details coming up.
Also in Zimbabwe, there are reports of people being killed and hundreds arrested as police crack down on the protests. And the UN is calling on Sudanese authorities to stop using excessive force to repress peaceful anti-government demonstrations.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's president has vowed to track down those responsible for attacking a five-star hotel in Nairobi, killing 21 people. Security forces have arrested 9 people, including the girlfriend of one of the 5 attackers, who were all killed. The Somalia-based extremist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the 20-hour siege Tuesday, calling it retaliation for U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. However, several analysts believe the attack was targeted more at Kenya for its troop commitment in Somalia and the multinational pursuit of al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab staged an attack in 2018 that killed 67 people in Nairobi's Westgate shopping center. The Kenyan Red Cross says everyone who had been in the hotel has been accounted for. Officials say all 5 attackers were killed. U.S. Ambassador Robert F. Gaddis issued a statement that also dismissed false reports on social media that the U.S. knew about the attack in advance and warned Americans to stay away from the area.
As reported, Kenyan police say the perpetrators of Tuesday's terrorist attack on a luxury hotel have been eliminated, and President Uhuru Kenyatta assures the public it is safe. But the incident could have a far-reaching impact on the nation's tourism industry. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The attack on the hotel complex came just as Kenya's tourism had mostly rebounded from al-Shabaab's 2013 attack on an upscale Nairobi mall, which contributed to a 20% drop in tourism the following year. Al-Shabaab says it carried out Tuesday's attack, although that has not been verified. Whoever was responsible, a similar decline in tourist traffic following this attack could be devastating. Government statistics show that 10% of Kenya's economy is related to tourism and travel. Ed Fuller is a travel industry expert who led Marriott Hotels International Division for over 2 decades.
Keep in mind, this is the first bomb in Nairobi. It will be very significant.
Fuller notes that Kenya's tourism industry is different from that of many destinations.
Kenya is not a mass market for tourism, but it's a very high-end market for tourism because of the nature of the touring that is done there.
That mostly means safaris, where tourists pay big money to experience the country's wildlife, such as lions, leopards, giraffes, rhinos, crocodiles, and baboons, in comfort.
It's an expensive trip for most people. It's a lifelong planning trip, and that is hard currency coming from Europe, Asia, and the Americas and Australia. So Kenya Air is impacted because that is one of the major carriers in that area. And you also have the immediate impact on the ground for the staff that works with all the tourists that come in there seasonally. And you also have an impact on the hotel.
In Fuller's experience, international market reactions to terrorism vary according to region. He says American news media tend to report terrorist attacks in a way that exaggerates the actual threat, and Asian tourists tend to be extra cautious. He says Europeans are more accustomed to volatility, so are often more willing to take a risk. But he adds that from every angle, Kenyan authorities face a huge marketing challenge.
Kenya is a brand. The United States is a brand. And when you're selling yourself to the rest of the world, anything that impacts your brand has impact on your success. And I have had discussions with people who say, you know, I'm planning to go on a safari And I've said, you know, you may want to just stay in Tanzania and skip Kenya this year because things are a little shaky there.
Professor Robert Salomon, who teaches business and globalization at New York University, says the only way Kenya's government can regain consumer confidence is to project safety and stability over the long term.
What tourists need to see is not just one-off measures taken by a particular government, but they need to see a track record of safety, and they need to see a track record of years that have gone by without incident. And then and only then will tourists come back in any kind of meaningful way. If we see these kinds of events on a regular basis, and I know that Kenya has struggled with terrorism in the past, then they will change their plans and they will avoid places like Kenya.
Despite efforts by Kenya's security forces, the African Union, the United States, and others to defeat al-Shabaab, the Somalia-based group maintains its ability to attack targets with fighters willing to die during the act. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The government is still trying to confirm the identities of some victims of Tuesday's attack, but a few names are known. Dedrick Lamisi was a 47-year-old CCTV operator. His father told journalists Lamisi was shot as he tried to rescue his colleagues. James Aduar would have turned 35 on Wednesday, but died shortly after the attack began. The employee of LG Electronics East Africa had a YouTube channel devoted to football. Friends Abdallah Sheikh Mohammed and Faisal Ahmed Rashid Dahir were having lunch when they were killed at a restaurant in the complex. Both men had worked on the Somalia Stability Fund, a project to bring peace and prosperity to Somalia. Jason Spindler survived the 9/11 attack in the U.S. in 2001, but died at the Dusa D2 complex. He was a founder of iDev International, a global consulting company. Luke Potter, a British and South African citizen, died at the complex also. He worked for the Gatsby Charitable Foundation on forestry programs for East Africa.
In Zimbabwe, the three-day stay-away protest has ended and the country is slowly getting back to business. The protest was in response to the government's decision to more than double fuel prices. The protests at times turned violent as people, fed up with shortages of fuel, food and currency, took to the streets in Bulawayo, Harare and major suburbs. There are reports of people being killed as police crack down on the protests, and hundreds have been arrested. The government has blocked social media platforms such as WhatsApp and Facebook, and at times the internet has been turned off. A leading government critic and rights activist, Evan Mawariri, has been arrested and charged with subversion. The U.S. Embassy in Harare has expressed concern about the reports of police attacking protesters and urged the government to restore access to social media. Adi Gondo is a journalist in Bulawayo. Earlier today, he spoke with our colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson.
Well, today things are grinding slowly back to normalcy, although most shops and businesses are closed in town. There were two department stores that were open and people were lining up to buy basic goods. And most of these people had traveled and walked all the way, like some 15 to 20 Ks on foot to get those goods that they need for everyday use. Because as you know, there was looting of shops in those townships. And so as you might expect, the shops do not have the goods that the people would need. So that is the situation, and soldiers were manning the queues, and police were also present. One of them actually threatened to drop me, and I had to walk away because I was interviewing some of the people that were in the queue, you know, to find out what exactly is it that they were doing and what their needs were.
What have you heard about casualties, people arrested, people injured over the last few days of protest?
So according to the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights, 172 cases have been handled by them, treated by them, and these ones, amongst these, 68 gunshot wounds. 17 had to receive, had to undergo emergency surgery, you know, for life-threatening situations or conditions. And then out of all those, 10 people died as a result of, you know, the clampdown by the security forces, allegedly. There are about 600 people that have been arrested. And in Bulawayo, as far as I understand right now, there are 4 people who have been to court. Their hearing is going to start at 2:30, and we're going to go there to monitor the situation.
Addy, what are the expectations for the coming days?
And so the expectation here now is I've seen something because I'm using VPN. You know that there was an internet shutdown, so I had to download the VPN so that I can have access to social media sites because they were blocked. There was a total shutdown, and then yesterday it was internet was back on for 30 minutes, and then you know, at which time I downloaded the VPN, and there was just that partial thing of not being able to access the social media sites. So the expectation, basically, I think, is that this thing is going to happen on a rolling basis, because I think I saw a social media post where people are saying stock up your goods, and then from the 17th they carry on with this. With this stairway. So the expectation is that something will have to give. Although, you know, it's not quite clear what was the end game, but it would be that it will register the discontent of Zimbabweans with the price hikes and, you know, basically the economic policy of the government this far. Because the price hike, the fuel price hike has precipitated massive price hikes in prices of basic goods. The basic thing that people need to understand is that apart from the stairway, affordability is a real issue because people simply can't afford to go to work. So politics aside, the cost of going to work is just beyond the reach of ordinary Zimbabweans, because in most cases bus fares have tripled, doubled, you know, and it's affecting everybody right across the social political divide.
And that was reporter Addy Gando in Bulawayo speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson.
Seventeen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Police fired tear gas again in Khartoum today to disperse demonstrators chanting freedom, peace, justice as they tried to march to the presidential palace where vehicles mounted with machine guns were deployed. Professional groups in the country today called for more protest in 12 cities across the country to press demands for President Omar al-Bashir to step aside after 30 years in power. Officials say 24 people have died and hundreds others have been wounded since the protests began December 19th after the government tripled the price of bread. Human rights groups say more than 40 have been killed. The protests have spread to at least 14 cities. More than 1,000 people have been arrested.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is calling on Sudanese authorities to stop using excessive force to repress peaceful anti-government demonstrations. Lisa Schlein reports from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
Protests against fuel shortages and the rising price of bread in Sudan began nearly a month ago. These quickly turned into demands for the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir, who has ruled for 30 years, and a change of government which the protesters view as deeply corrupt. Ravina Shamdasani, spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, tells VOA the government's response has only made things worse. Numerous witnesses say security forces have fired tear gas and live ammunition at peaceful protesters.
So we are calling on the government to ensure that any reports of excessive use of force, including live ammunition by the state security forces, are investigated and that they engage in a dialogue with the protesters instead of seeking to repress them.
The government confirms 24 people have died in the course of the protests. The UN says it has credible reports indicating the death toll may be twice as high. Sudanese authorities also confirm that up to January 6th, at least 816 protesters have been arrested. They reportedly include journalists, opposition leaders, and members of civil society. Shamdasani says these tactics have not deterred people from holding peaceful rallies in a number of cities across Sudan. She says they are being organized by professional doctors, lawyers, and journalist associations. So far, she says, there do not seem to be any moves toward dialogue to end the standoff.
In fact, what we have seen is that the president himself has been attending pro-government rallies while the security forces are cracking down on anti-government rallies.
Shamdasani says High Commissioner Bachelet has been in touch with Sudanese authorities. She has offered to deploy a human rights team to advise them and help ensure they act in accordance with their international human rights obligations. Shamdasani says the High Commissioner is awaiting their response. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Angolan President João Lourenço has made major changes in the nation's vital oil sector since taking power in 2017. Economists say these changes should improve Angola's economy and may even provide a model for other resource-rich African nations. But Lourenço's critics say the reforms are cosmetic and haven't brought benefits to ordinary Angolans. VOA's Anita Powell takes a closer look from Johannesburg.
Oil has long been a blessing and a curse for citizens of this southern African nation. Allies of longtime President José Eduardo dos Santos allegedly enriched themselves off oil profits, while most citizens remained desperately poor. But since taking office in 2017, President João Lourenço has been making welcome changes. NJIUK heads a Johannesburg-based Centurion Law Group and chairs the Africa Energy Chamber of Commerce.
The current president really has, I wouldn't really say he has turned it around. He has taken some major steps that the industry has been waiting and the economy has been looking at. And we are seeing things improving if these steps are actually implemented and they actually go forward.
Lourenço is trying to diversify the oil-dependent economy, announcing the nation's first diamond auction later this month. He also sacked several of the former president's children from top positions, including his daughter, who was running the state oil company, Sonangol. Lourenço also reformed Sonangol, streamlining operations and regulations to make it easier for foreign investors to work in the oil sector. But economist Kobus de Hart of NKC African Economics says it's too soon to be optimistic.
So most of the improvement is due to higher oil prices. And obviously it'll take some time for the reforms at Sonangol to translate into increased earnings and also a marked improvement in efficiency. But moves thus far do seem to have attracted more interest from global oil majors to invest more in the country.
Angolan journalist and human rights activist Rafael Marques, a frequent critic of the government, says the leadership changes at the state oil company are cosmetic and misleading.
The way contracts are allocated, you still have companies that belong to politically exposed persons providing services. So some reforms have been implemented, but the point is not to replace one set of crooks by another set of crooks. Much of the public contracts he's signing off are without public tender. And remember, that's where the oil money goes to.
Nonetheless, the Africa Energy Chamber of Commerce's IUC, who recently visited Angola, says he is hopeful. He says if Angola continues reforming its oil industry, it could trigger similar efforts in other African countries.
What is really exciting is that most observers are looking at this and saying, maybe this could be something that we can really build upon and look at the model that works for Africa. The truth of the matter is that if Angola gets it right, there is no reason why Mozambique or South Africa or Namibia or Nigeria or Equatorial Guinea cannot get it right. Because people are tired of seeing these resources not translate to development.
But if Angola's oil reforms remain limited, its effort to extract itself from the so-called resource curse may take some more refining. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Egypt and Israel are in talks to build an undersea natural gas pipeline between the two countries to allow Israel to export increasing quantities of gas to Europe via its Arab neighbor. Egypt, Israel, Cyprus, Greece, Jordan, and Italy have agreed to increase cooperation as more of the recently developed undersea gas production comes online. Egypt already has a pipeline to Europe and exports from its large Al-Zohar undersea field, along with production by its neighbors, are expected to help parts of southern Europe with its gas needs. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Egypt's liquefied natural gas plants are increasing production as more natural gas from its large offshore gas fields comes online. Egypt's neighbors, including Israel, also have been increasing cooperation in an effort to take advantage of and export undersea natural gas production, which has been slowly ramped up since discoveries of the past several years. Israeli Energy Minister Yuval Steinitz was invited to Egypt's Regional Natural Gas Conference Tuesday to discuss further cooperation in exporting Israel's own undersea gas reserves to Europe. Officials from more than a half dozen countries, including Egypt, Israel, Jordan, the Palestinian Authority, Greece, Cyprus, and Italy, attended. Steinitz was the first Israeli minister to be invited to visit Cairo by the Egyptian government since the revolution in 2011, and he lauded the increasing cooperation between the two governments. He says the development of natural gas in Israel, Egypt, and Cyprus has become a motor for geostrategic and political cooperation across the whole of the Eastern Mediterranean. He adds that Egypt, Israel, Jordan, the Palestinian Authority, Cyprus, Greece, and Italy will cooperate to develop natural resources for the benefit of the region. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, whose nation's own extensive offshore natural gas reserves have proven to be a boon to both the Egyptian treasury and its own consumers of natural gas, told a recent gathering that Egypt is working hard to develop the resource. He says that God has blessed Egypt with self-sufficiency and even more than that in natural gas reserves, and it is only for the purpose of increasing the distribution network across the country that the government has raised prices. Political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that Egypt is becoming a regional hub for gas exports and that its neighbors, like Israel, are making use of the fact it has existing undersea pipelines to Europe in order to increase their own exports.
Already Egypt has long pipelines since long ago, and it is ready. If other countries want to build a pipeline, it is expensive and it will take a long time, and they don't have enough gas for sustainable export. Egypt has one of the biggest gas fields in the Mediterranean, Al-Zohr. And that's why Egypt has this potential that they will be exporting, and they will take from smaller fields that their neighbors have and buy them, we export them and make a difference.
Sadiq says he does not think gas exports to Europe from Egypt, Israel, or Cyprus will affect the dependence of Western Europe on Russian natural gas, however, since most of the Mediterranean gas will be going to Southern and Central Europe. He also says cooperation between Israel and Egypt will not stir up any serious opposition inside the country. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Shogun Chow, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.